Welcome to Water Insider, a podcast brought to you by DHI. Whether you work with urban or inland water systems, marine or offshore, we get experts to discuss everything water, so you can be the first to learn the latest in water tech and trends.
Welcome, everyone. My name is Mercedes Boudouin, a producer here at the Water Insider podcast, and I'll be hosting today's episode. This year marks the 30th anniversary of the first offshore wind farm installation. The offshore wind industry is accelerating rapidly and even considered one of the world's fastest growing energy sources. But how has the offshore wind industry changed over the past 30 years, and where is it heading? We'll dive into these topics together with two experts from DHI, Henrik Kofoel Hansen, Senior Technical Expert for Ports and Offshore Technology, and Frank Thompson, Senior Marine Scientist. Welcome both.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Let's start from the beginning. This is going to go for Henrik. In 1991, Elcraft, later Dong Energy, now Ørsted, launched the first offshore wind farm off the coast of Denmark. What were you doing then, and what was your reaction to the first offshore wind farm in 1991?
30 years ago, wow. Yeah, I got actually my master's degree from DTU that year, and immediately after I was employed at DHI. It was an exciting time for a young and ambitious engineer. We did some breaking research and field experiments at the Vinnebu site where the new offshore wind farm was established. On air-sea interaction, that was really the start of my career within the offshore wind business.
Wow. Very exciting to be around during that.
It was.
And then Frank, what about you? Did you have a similar experience, or what were you doing during that time?
Well, I had quite a different experience than compared to Henrik. I think I graduated in a little bit later. I mean, at the end of the 90s, 1999, and the topic for my thesis was the acoustic behavior, the noise behavior of marine mammals, of whales in Canadian waters. And the job chances with this kind of PhD dissertation were next to nothing in Northern Germany, where I graduated in Hamburg. So one day I was sitting at the university I think I was working on my CV for job applications and so on. So I was in the lab, and along came this guy, and it later turned out he was a consultant for an offshore wind farm. And he just walked around and asked people, does anyone know here anything about whales and underwater sound? And in that instance, I had a really good chance, and this was an opening for me to get a job. So I've been working on these issues since then.
It's such a drastic change from back then to now. It seems like offshore wind energy is almost mainstream and accelerating in demand. What do you think have been the biggest milestones or influences over the past 30 years, specifically related to regulations, processes, tools, data? Frank, do you want to go first on this one?
Well, I don't think there has been one single milestone, but actually many. I think the realization of the first offshore wind farms in Denmark and the UK have definitely led to lessons learned when it comes to, for example, environmental impacts and how to assess them, and especially also to how to monitor actually the impacts from an offshore wind farm. So that was really milestones. Then, of course, in Germany, a while back, 20 years back, the first standards for environmental impact assessment were published, and that really provided security for the developers on how to do, you know, these impact assessments. So that was definitely a milestone. And then overall, I think, know that it actually works, that it's actually possible to install an offshore wind farm. That's definitely a milestone when it comes to the first developments in Denmark and the UK.
Absolutely. Henrik, do you agree with these milestones, or does a different milestone stand out to you?
If we take them a little bit higher level, I think the single most important milestone for the industry has been the ability to deliver cheaper, clean energy compared to fossil-based energy, especially during the last 10 years. I mean, this is a major achievement, and the entire supply chain should be very proud of it. That said, I mean, without visionary and supporting governments and policymakers setting ambitious climate targets, focusing on research and development and innovation programs, we would never have been where we are today. So it's really called for long-term planning at many different levels. And this is really crucial to get developers and the entire supply chain to be committed. And yes, Europe, Germany, Denmark was pioneer, Europe afterwards. And now we see that it's moving on to Asia Pacific and North America as emerging rapidly.
Speaking of these rapidly emerging offshore wind markets, which regions are you most excited to work with in supporting their offshore wind development in the coming years? Why?
There are so many opportunities. I mean, we have been working a lot in Poland, and the attractive thing about it is actually that the regulatory development was not so very high at the beginning. But, you know, now the wind farms are established with a very low environmental footprint due to the very good environmental impact assessments that have been undertaken. So we see a huge benefit on being the pioneers in a new market. So that's definitely really a big reward, and it continues to excite me to support this development. And then, of course, the U.S. is the new frontier of offshore wind, of course, because the U.S. is a very, very large market with a lot of developments and a lot of interesting environmental and other issues. So that is, of course, very exciting. But Henrik is working across the world, so you might add other regions that are of interest for him.
Always exciting to work with emerging new countries because it's different cultures, different standardizations, different kind of way of doing things, and we have to learn from each other. But in general, I do not have any specific preferences, but the first emerging Asian Pacific market is exciting and challenging on many fronts. So I'm looking after that and already heavily engaged and learning every day.
Oh yeah, definitely lots of learning, but it's very exciting. What do you think are the major technical influences, changes, or innovations that have helped the industry advance over the past 30 years specifically?
That's a very good question. I mean, it's quite a complex industry, so there are many. But I think the key innovation across the entire supply chain and its industrialization is crucial. To be more concrete, the growing size of the wind turbines has had a significant influence on the power price. Today we work with 8 12 megawatt turbines, but within a few years from now we will work with 14 15 megawatt turbines, which will be standard, and these have about 40 times higher capacity compared to where we started 30 years ago. And imagine that each of these single turbine, or I will call it a power plant, will deliver power to about 10,000 homes.
It's impressive to see how technology is helping us advance this industry so much faster. But that same goes with society as a whole. So this, I guess, goes to Frank then. Do you think the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals are influencing offshore wind development?
Well, there are two goals, UN sustainability goals, that are directly applicable to offshore wind. One is number 7, which is the reliable, sustainable, and modern energy for all. And then the goal number 14, which is addressing marine life and conservation of life below water. So both are actually directly applicable. I'm not sure if there will be a direct impact from these goals, but I think they will indirectly foster research, for example, on European level. European project funds will be available. In fact, there have been European funds looking at, for example, my issue, underwater noise impacts on marine life. We have performed a review some years back, and I think there will be more work in this topic. And then, you know, we have seen also that companies react to these kind of global trends. We have seen a shift in some of the major oil and gas players from oil and gas to actually investing heavily, very heavily in offshore wind recently.
Yeah, it's incredible what just setting targets and goals like this can do to motivate companies.
Exactly. And if you look, for example, at the US right now, I mean, this regulatory landscape and the kind of incentives in the US, not so much the regulatory landscape, but the incentives have changed with the new administration, of course, very largely. There's a lot of support now for offshore wind, and that will actually have some major influences on the industry as a whole, I think.
Absolutely. As mentioned earlier, Europe has been a major influencer in this industry. But how are other regions learning and adapting from these European examples? And what have been their biggest challenges on their offshore wind energy journey?
Europe has been a very successful pioneer in the offshore wind business, which has been an invaluable inspiration and learning for many emerging offshore wind countries. And this learning is at many different levels. I mean, from long-term energy planning fit in tariff models, federal versus regional legislation, and not least how to build up a local and efficient supply chain. I mean, there's been tons of delegation across the globe, both virtually and also physically over the last many years. And now we see it's really taking off in Asia Pacific and also in North America. It's a little bit difficult for me to point out a single biggest challenge as it varies from country to country. But many European authorities, developers, and also private industry are supporting many of these emerging markets to get started quickly. And the next decade will really take off. So that's exciting.
What about you, Frank? Do you see these other regions being able to take these learnings and really fly with them?
Well, I think there are two main challenges when it comes to the environmental issues. One is providing, as I said, the regulatory landscape, really the decision process, managing or implementing a decision process where offshore wind farms can be consented rather swiftly because there's so much demand, but at the same time protecting the environment. That's a challenge for all, for everyone, but especially, of course, for the upcoming markets because they simply lack the experience from the European example. And I think this is where also information transfer comes in. Visits, you know, workshops, meetings, conferences are really, really very important in this context. And then, you know, connected to that, it's simply managing the environmental issues. I mean, they are very different in other areas compared to Europe. In the US, for example, we have large whales that are very sensitive to low frequency sound from pile driving. In Taiwan, we have the humpback dolphin, so the species and that is highly protected in these waters and needs special attention. So we have actually specific issues in each of these new areas that needs to be addressed. And of course, you can learn from the European example, but you can only learn so much because some of the issues are very specific.
That's so true. I mean, this industry is complex and each project's context is so different. So its success and its environmental impacts are 100% based on the accurate data and analyses of these site-specific contexts.
I want to pivot the conversation just a little bit. Specifically, I want to talk to each of you a little bit more about your expertise related to the past 30 years of offshore wind, in your opinion. So for Henrik, what are the major changes in offshore meta-ocean engineering services in the past 30 years? And how do you think they will develop in the next 30 years?
And now you're getting really technical, right? Very specific, but good question, though. Thanks. It's no secret that fit for purpose and quality mid-ocean data and analytics have been one of my key interests for decades. Why? Because I know solid and reliable data is crucial for any successful offshore wind or other project at the sea at all the different phases. It really matters. So the combination of solid and proven numerical models, both for the atmosphere and the ocean, and access to huge computational power resources allow us to calculate accurately mid-ocean conditions any places within a fraction of time compared to, say, 10 years ago. It also allows us to undertake much more advanced analysis and to disseminate these results digitally smarter, quicker, and cheaper, which eventually will save cost of green power. Started 30 years ago and see where we are today, that's an amazing journey. Sometimes a little bit unbelievable, but 30 years is also a bit of peace. About future development, well, where will it take us? I guess we will see much more seamless integration of different kind of sensor data, whether it's satellite data or other kind of devices, and also simulated data to further increase the accuracy and reliability of data. I mean, this is the crucial thing. Reliable data feeding into decision-making is what we need. I also expect that many of the modeling and analysis tasks we are undertaking today will be automatized, allowing much quicker data access and always having up-to-date data. And data will be accompanied with uncertainty assessment, which is missing a little bit today, but I think it's crucial. And maybe one day we will see blockchain technology also used in this space, allowing stakeholders to keep track of the data and its background.
I think that future for MetOcean engineering services and technologies sounds bright. But is it the same for you, Frank, related to your expertise in environmental impact assessments and technologies? How have they evolved in the last 30 years?
Well, it's kind of similar, but then there are some specifics, of course. If we look at the areas of improvement, I think we have seen huge progress in monitoring. I went out 20 years ago in an airplane counting harbor porpoises, little whales in the North Sea, using, you know, my eyes, basically, in an airplane and a window, you know, that was called a bubble window, that was bubbled out, so you could actually stick your head out and
count adventure.
The animals below the airplane. Yeah, it was very adventurous, but it was not the, you know, technology that had, of course, also some problems. Nowadays, we have high-definition video aerial surveys that are perhaps a little bit more reliable. I mean, these other aerial surveys are still used because humans are very good at counting things, but high-def video, for example, is definitely an advantage. Then we have seen, you know, huge progress in all kinds of other monitoring, like acoustic monitoring, monitoring of underwater noise, which can be done now in many instances online. We have developed multi-sensor bird detection systems where you can actually detect birds flying through a wind farm and assess the risk of collision. That's a huge progress in 24/7 monitoring in existing offshore wind farms. Then progress also in managing the environmental impacts. We have been talking here in another podcast on underwater noise, mitigation systems. So I don't want to go into detail, but there has been a great progress on this aspect. And then simply also when Henrik has explained that a little bit in the modeling, but from an ecological point of view, we are actually interested in finding out not only who is there and when they are there, like the animals in an area, but actually why they are in an area, what actually drives their movements and what are the major influences. And this can be only done using spatial ecological modeling and using dynamic habitat modeling, for example, and then agent-based modeling for describing movement of animals. So huge progress in these technologies. And in the future, I mean, Henrik has mentioned data portals, so I no details here for my part because I can only agree with them. Then we will see the rise or implementation of machine learning when it comes to ecological modeling, I think. I think we will also see an increase in online monitoring and modeling of noise and other pressures. And what is really important is that these offshore wind farms are actually potentially platforms of opportunity for monitoring. If you want to monitor biodiversity, for example, you know, the life below water and also pressures, these offshore wind farms are ideal platforms. I mean, we have, alone in Germany, we have hundreds of steel sticks standing in the water and they're actually only producing wind, but they can produce a lot of data too. So there's definitely an opportunity.
Yeah, it definitely seems aligned that data on demand and the variety of data on demand is going to be really important here to reach goals. But speaking of goals, the European Commission has really big goals for offshore wind infrastructures to scale up from producing 25 gigawatts today to delivering more than 300 gigawatts in 30 years from now, which will help deliver climate neutrality by 2050. Such scaling requires a visionary approach, though. So what sort of actions, attitudes, and regulations will need to be adopted to reach this goal? Frank, would you like to start?
Yeah, sure. I think this is an incentive for collaboration on what we call transboundary issues. I mean, a lot of the impacts from an offshore wind farm are actually transboundary, so they reach across borders. Sound can travel underwater tens of kilometers, and birds can fly, of course, through entire ocean basins. So there will be a triggering of, you know, working together. And actually, there is a policy framework that actually it's a very strong incentive to do so. That's in Europe, the Marine Strategy Framework Directive, that actually defines good environmental status and has each member state has to achieve good environmental status in European waters using descriptors. And one of the key pillars of this Marine Strategy Framework Directive, at least in Europe, is a collaboration when it comes to environmental targets and assessments across nations. So there is already a policy framework out that actually fosters this kind of collaboration. And then in more generic terms, I think the huge challenge is making the approval process more streamlined. I mean, a lot of these approval processes are very lengthy and rightly so in a way, yeah. because the issues are very important. But you know, we have to be a little bit better in streamlining the regulation without, of course, neglecting the environmental issues.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's so complex and there's so many things within the environment to analyze. You don't want to miss them. But at the same time, like you said, the process takes so long that we need to have it more streamlined. Do you have similar opinions, Henrik?
I think the most important thing is now the Commission set these kind of goals is that when it's going further in the system, that the EU member countries are taking that seriously and make some clear and visionary plans for each country. And I think I'm proud to be a citizen in Denmark who has been very active in that, where we decided last year to establish two major energy hubs and with associated offshore wind farms to meet the goal of 70% CO2 emission cut in just 10 years from now. And one of the hubs is actually an artificial island in the North Sea for the first time in the world, serving initially 3 gigawatt of offshore wind power and later up to 10 gigawatt. That's a massive and complex development, but doable. Such kind of initiatives is going on in many European countries. We just have to see even more to deliver on the overall goals.
It's honestly wonderful to hear there's so many regulations and actions being taken to meet these targets. But big question then for both of you. Henrik, you can go first. Where do you see the offshore wind industry in the next 30 years?
I'm pretty sure the second half of this game towards climate neutrality in 2050 will be very exciting for us working within the offshore wind power business. For sure, the floating offshore wind, we've been talking about that for years, will now take off during the next decade at a much higher speed than seen previously. And costs will get down, as we have seen it with fixed turbine foundation concept the last decade. But again, we need further automation, standardization, and not least digitalization to scale up. This is required for the entire industry. To that said, I think the single biggest challenge during the next, say, 10 years is to develop smart and cost-effective methods to convert offshore wind power to green fuels, as we call it, P2X. That will make a huge impact on the CO2 footprint and also air pollution when the transport sector moves into a zero carbon fuel. And here, visionary governments and policymakers quickly need to develop these strategies and incentives to make this happen. And I just would like to make a Søren Skov, the CEO of A.P. Møller-Mærsk, said at the meeting at the World Economic Forum earlier this week. He said that fossil fuels are cheap, they are easily available, and very reliable, which make them a tough competition for green fuels. Therefore, we need regulation that can start to ensure that we have great availability of green powers. I mean, this is exactly what we need. We all know that the regulation eventually will work, even though it's hard.
Absolutely.
What about you, Frank?
Well, Henrik has pretty much said it all, but what I can actually add that I see it as part of the mix, of course, of the future energy supply. So wind farms, of course, play an important role, especially offshore. I see them as a trigger for innovation. I think one thing I learned over the last 20 years is that a lot of innovation in, you know, monitoring, analysis, and management of environmental impacts came from these offshore wind farms. And this will continue in the future. That will trigger innovation and new developments. And then, of course, they, as I said, there can be platforms of opportunity. And not only platforms of opportunity, they can be used for all kinds of things. We know that, for example, if fishing doesn't occur in an offshore wind farm, it can be some kind of sanctuary for marine life, not only you know, creating new energy, but maybe also you know, being protected areas for marine mammals to hide from, you know, whatever bycatch from fishing or so on. So there can be a lot of added benefits to having these offshore wind farms. But of course, we have to have also the methodologies to assess the impacts, the adverse impacts in a very comprehensive manner.
Oh yeah, it seems we never stop learning. So we're reaching the end of our episode now.
But, you know, after talking with you guys, I'm even more excited about the future of offshore wind development around the world. Henrik, Frank, thank you so much for joining today and for sharing your insights.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much. It has been a pleasure.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. Stay tuned for more episodes on offshore wind.
Thanks for listening to Water Insider. You can find more episodes on our website, dhigroup.com, or anywhere you get your podcasts. And don't forget to follow us.